The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Alexis Petridis. This is Music Weekly. This week...
This work was more like a sonic cathedral, building that, because it all has to interlock, and it's a very big project. When you're doing a record, you're doing chalets, wonderful condos, all kinds of things.
Tori Amos talks sonic architecture and the challenge of blending songs into a classical music structure. We review new tracks from Friends, St. Vincent and Pissed Lanny, and we discuss the retirement of REM. That's all on this week's Music Weekly from The Guardian. Hello and welcome to the programme. Hello to Dorian Linsky.
Hello.
How you doing?
Good, thank you.
Excellent. And Alex McPherson, a podcast virgin.
Hiya.
Now, you went to meet Tori Amos this week. We'll be hearing some extracts from your conversation with her in a few moments, but let's start with some new music, Singles Club. Here are the tracks we each love this week. We will start with Dorian's choice. That's St. Vincent and Cheerleader, brought in by Dorian. Dorian, tell us about St. Vincent, tell us about Cheerleader, tell us why you love this track.
Well, this is my favourite album at the moment. I quite liked the first album, then was really wowed by the second one. And this one, I think, is, you know, as good, if not better, than the second one. And what I chose this song is because it kind of represents the two poles of you know, her sound on this record, what she's working with, which on the one hand is this very... you know, beautiful, atmospheric, melodic quality. You know, she can do that. She's got the voice. She's got the arrangements and the tunes. But then with this kind of gnarly, heavy, distorted quality that she brings to quite a lot of the songs. You know, that...
It sounded exactly like St. Vincent was with us in the studio.
The silhouette. In silhouette, we're actually uncannily similar.
anyway, sorry, I interrupt you, carry on.
I just think she's a really fascinating songwriter, and that I think she's kind of getting her dues critically on this record. I think she deserves to be talked about a lot more, because she's good, like I say, she's got that songwriting chops. She's a very interesting lyricist. Mm-hmm. But she's always trying to do unexpected things with the production, and I know that a few people have been alienated by that on this record and find it too abrupt and distorted in places. But I think it just stops it being too comfortable, too bland. She's always pushing it in different directions.
I like it enormously. Alex, what do you make of it?
I'm not really sure. This is the first time I've actually heard St. Vincent. I've been quite slow in getting around to it. I'm getting a bit of a Cat Power vibe, but I tried to give the album a listen, and it was actually the lo-fi production that turned me off slightly. Right. I liked the track that Dorian picked out, but there's one before in the album which is just so lo-fi, and the melody is so basic, and I just wasn't feeling it particularly.
A difference of opinion. I really like it. I was unaware of her work prior, really, to Strange Mercy. I hadn't heard the album before that. The first thing that I came across was somebody forwarded, might have been you actually, Dorian, forwarded me a video of her covering Kerosene by Big Black live on stage, which is a tough song to cover, and it was brilliant. It was absolutely amazing, really balls out kind of cover of a great song, and I have investigated further from that, and I really like her.
She's also, as that video showed, she's a phenomenal guitarist, but you know, she can do the shredding, but she sort of doesn't choose to do that too much on this record. I like the fact that it seems that she's got these very obvious strengths, but that she wants to do different things.
Yeah, absolutely. There's also another video knocking about on YouTube of her covering the Beatles' Dig a Pony. Not a song I particularly like, and her version of it is absolutely awesome. So I would advise anybody interested in St. Vincent or Beatles covers to check it out. That's St. Vincent and Cheerleader. It's out now. Next up, it's Alex's choice.
I ran in ball, but I took the arc and poor old Billy. Bless him.
Pistolani and Hell on Heels. Alex, you brought that in. Tell us, I'm unaware of the work of Pistolani, or I was prior to you bringing this in. Tell us a little bit about her, it, them, and about this track.
It's actually Pistol Annie's. It's a girl group. It's a country girl group set up by Miranda Lambert, who you may or may not have heard of, but she's a fantastic country songwriter and singer.
Is this Nashville traditional kind of thing? Is this alt country? What is it?
Yeah, it's pretty traditional country. It's not sort of alt country or anything.
But I mean, is she part of that kind of Nashville establishment? Is she writing for kind of big Nashville stars? That kind of that's
she's singing her own right.
What do you like about it?
She's brought together sort of Ashley Monroe and Angelina Presley to form this sort of country girl group. And over the course of their album, that's the title track, which is obviously a sort of celebrating being a gold digger. But the album itself turns out to be a really good recession album, actually. They sing about poverty, they sing about these characters, sort of these downtrodden housewives who sort of fantasize about burning their houses down.
Wow.
They sing about family feuds. They sing about sort of being addicted to prescription pills and so on.
Wow.
It makes me think that country is very much the sort of poor white American version of R&B and hip-hop.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I think that's quite a commonly held view. What sets them apart? What provides their bit of edge, do you think?
Lambert's songwriting as ever. I'm not sure if you've heard Gunpowder and Lead, which was from about 5-6 years ago, which is probably one of the best singles of the past decade. But Pistol Annie's, it's just sort of little details in the songwriting, little flashes of humour, sort of really sort of catch you and hook you in.
Excellent. Dorian, Pistol Annie's, Hell on Heels.
What it reminds me is that there's a certain prejudice among English listeners, and I think also among, more perhaps alt-minded fans, against this Nashville craftsmanship.
Absolutely.
You know, I gave a positive review to Taylor Swift Live, loads of people, you know, complained. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, no big deal there. But, you know, the idea that sort of celebrating her as a very clever songwriter was somehow absurd.
Yeah.
And I must admit, you know, when Miranda Lambert first appeared, and in fact, her first album was called Kerosene. But when she first appeared, I was kind of like, you know, this isn't for me. You know, I'm not into that kind of mainstream country. But as Alex points out, it's all in the detail. You know, that kind of craft, which is almost in the bones of these artists. Mm-hmm. That way of telling a story, that way of creating a character, those little flashes of humour, those little twists. Mm-hmm. There's just something really kind of, it's not new, but I do find there's something that I admire more and more. It's that sort of old-fashioned professionalism.
Yeah, I think there's a really interesting comparison to be made between those kind of Nashville songwriters and the big pop songwriting teams, in that they both go for that kind of total watertight, airtight professionalism. But the difference, it strikes me, is that they're both interested in melodies, but Nashville songwriters are interested in lyrics, you know what I mean, and in a way that most pop songwriters just aren't. It's very much a secondary consideration if you're writing for, insert, you know, Britney Spears or something like that, whereas in country music it's a necessary and required part of the music to have, you know, incredibly well-written song, lyrics that tell a story and push things on and, you know what I mean, have motion in them, that kind of thing.
It's a folk tradition. It's about telling stories. It's about crafting characters and narratives and sort of passing that down to the next generation almost. Mm-hmm. And there's a song on the Pistol Annie's album called Housewife's Prayer, and the opening line is, I've been thinking about burning this house down, which is just a sort of pow opening line.
Yeah. You really want to hear the rest of the song if that's the opening line, you know?
And I like that tradition also of bringing humour, very sort of sardonic humour, to very sort of, you know, dark and grown-up topics, which again doesn't get as much credit than as if it was, you know, done in a kind of alt-country way where people assume that they will be, you know, dark and grown-up and when witty.
It's really strange, I think, the disjunction, particularly in the British public's mind, between, you know, people are perfectly prepared to listen to a Hank Williams record from, you know what I mean, 1943. They're perfectly prepared to listen to alt country. And there seems to be this complete disjunct, you know, they're perfectly prepared to listen to Kris Kristofferson. But, you know, there seems to be just a point at which people go, country fans in Britain go, no, I'm not listening to, you know what I mean, the music of Nashville, the mainstream music of Nashville. And it's not at the point where the Nashville sound goes all syrupy and Jim Reevesy, because, you know, they're perfectly prepared to listen to Willie Nelson records from the 70s, that kind of thing. And I don't really understand where the prejudice lies, and I don't really understand why there's this sense that because somebody's, you know, a sort of hipster with a beard from Kentucky or whatever. You know what I mean? That their music is automatically valued in a way that the work of a really strong Nashville songwriting team isn't.
I think it's because people feel that they don't necessarily want... It's a social thing. Pistolani's sing about basically working-class white women mm-hmm. and their experience, and the sort of, it's very, very red state as well. Their references to living in a trailer, their references mm-hmm. to religion, their references to being a third-generation bartender, mm-hmm. While everyone else in her town went off and got degrees. Mm-hmm. And I think when a lot of alt-minded listeners, as you put it, mm-hmm. listen to music, they want to feel like they... could be friends or in the same social milieu as the artist they're listening to.
That's really fascinating.
And that doesn't apply to someone like Miranda Lambert, who's obviously not singing to them.
Mm-hmm. In a distant milieu, the kind of black working class experience is fetishized in a way that the white one really isn't.
Yeah.
You know, in hip-hop, it's got a lot of these, you know, the beardy hipsters would be happily listening to stuff about, you know, hip-hop songs about a life that they really know nothing about. Mm. But transfer that to, as Alex says, you know, Red State, you know, whisper it. The characters in these songs might be Republicans.
Yeah, yeah.
And suddenly there's this huge gulf.
Mm. This is all really fascinating. Pistol Annie's Hell on Heels is the lead track, the title track,
yes,
of their album. It's also been out as a single. It was released last month. Check it out if you like the sound of it. Finally, my choice. That's Friends with My Boo. That's my choice this week. I have a limited tolerance for Brooklyn hipster bands covering 90s R&B tracks, but I just put this on and I really liked it. I wasn't actually that aware of the original, although I have checked it out online subsequently, because I didn't realise it was a cover the first time I heard it a few weeks ago. It's not really an era of R&B I know that much about, to be honest with you, beyond the odd TLC record. I just think that really works as a intriguing piece of pop music. I just think it's a really good song. It stands up to whatever treatment's meted out to it, and I just really liked it. There you go, Dorian.
Yeah, I didn't know the original either, actually.
I think it was a bigger hit in America than it was here, because it seemed to be, you know what I mean, the general consensus of opinion on YouTube was this was a complete classic and blah, 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 blah.
I can't believe you didn't know the original.
What? Who's it by?
Ghost Town DJs. It's one of my favourite ever songs.
Oh, well, there you go.
I was one of those benighted people, yeah, like Alexis, you know, sort of pre, like Timbaland was really the turning point for me with R&B, and before then I like knew, you know, two TLC singles.
Yeah.
And didn't really listen to R&B in the mid-90s. But obviously I missed out on a winner here. But what I like about the cover version is that there was a few years ago, you had this terrible phase where basically if a white band, indie-ish band, covered, an urban record, there was some degree of, like, self-congratulation.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
hey, I know it's a pop song, but it's actually really good if you play it on guitars, you know. And it's just, you know, Razor Lights, Hey Ya being the kind of absolute idea of recorded music.
But you say that. Have you heard Keane's version of Bootylicious?
Oh yeah, no, actually, that's worse, isn't it?
Zane Lowe, can you handle this? Anyway, carry on.
But this felt more in the spirit of the XX doing Aaliyah's Hot Light Fire. That there's now a kind of generation of bands who. R&B is totally part of their landscape. You know, it's a natural reference point. And so they do it. I mean, is this better than the original? Probably not. But it's certainly no disgrace, and it's certainly sincerely meant and sort of expertly done.
Yeah, it's not the funny cover version from track 4 of Appeal Session. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think it's interesting. If you listen to the other stuff by Friends, you're absolutely right. I think R&B is part of the landscape. It seems to exist in a tradition of kind of New York bands that has less to do with Brooklyn hipsterdom in a way, and you know, I sort of see them as being a bit like the Tom Tom Club, a bit like the Waitresses, you know, bands like that from the early 80s. Alex.
Well, I didn't like that.
Okay.
It just seems pointless. I'll give you that they're sincere, and I'll give you that they're not sort of mocking it or sort of being detached from it, but but it's just so pointless. I don't understand what kind of person would hear the original, which is perfect, it's actual perfection, and say, you know, what the world needs is my take on it. No, don't do that.
Well, it's the, you know, pre the kind of novelty phase of like rock bands doing, you know, covering soul R&B songs. You had that really interesting period, sort of post-punk period, when you had Talking Heads doing Take Me to the River or The Slits doing Heard It Through the Grapevine. And there was a sense that you were really relocating the mood of the song and finding a kind of different tension and friction. And, you know, it was genuinely an alternative to the original. Whereas this, like the XX Hot Like Fire, which, you know, I really like Alex says, it doesn't really add anything.
I would agree with that.
It's just a nice cover version.
And also, it's just performed slightly wrong. She oversings it, the beats are too cluttered. It sort of removes the lightness, which is really essential to the original, without sort of really replacing it with anything. Over the years, lots of people have tried to have a go at My Boo. It is a classic song. And the only one that I've heard that does it justice is the remix of Mariah Carey's Hate You, in which she interpolates it and sort of weaves it into her original. And it really works as a counterpoint to her original song, which is about wanting to, you know, hate someone, get over them, but not being able to. So weaving this lovely sort of song about a crush into it sort of really works.
Interesting. That, anyway, Friends, cover of My Boo. It is the B-side of the next single, I'm His Girl. I think it's actually rather better than the A-side. And that is out on October the 31st. Moving on, not too many comments on the blog last week because of a technicality at our end, sorry. But remember, you can always tweet us at musicweeklypod, all one word, or mail us musicweekly, all one word, at guardian.co.uk, if that is ever the case in future and you're really desperate to communicate something to us. However, we did get comments from Dave Portivo, who penned probably his longest comment ever, and we'll focus in on his festival lowlights this year, which were the Eagles at Hop Farm. My God. My God, the horror, he said. Never again. And BDI attempting to sub-headline Isle of Wight. I saw a bit of that on telly.
I love the idea of sub-headlining something.
Yeah, sub-headlining is like a phrase made up by a press officer, isn't it? They're sub-headlining. It's like that means they're not headlining.
They were sub good.
They were sub good. This album is a bit sub amazing.
They were heavily submerged in the mud.
Oh dear. Aquinas, whose highlights were Hello Black, good show and musicianship, Sam and the Womp, Insanity on Stage.
Is this a Brass High style kind of stuff?
And Herman the Tosser. And Ooh is an Instrument, who he said provided surprising intimacy. Comments.
I can see why there's the highlights. You'd be laughing so much at the names that, you know, there's your entertainment right there.
It was an instrument. The surprising instrument.
Surprising sounds like an offence.
He was caught on
surprising intimacy.
The jury was shown CCTV footage of his surprising intimacy. And he's been jailed for 9 months. Comments and links are all at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. So, this week's Music Weekly interview is with Tori Amos. Her new album, Night of the Hunters, is out this week, and it's an interesting mix of songs and classical music featuring themes of Irish mythology. Alex here is a super fan, so we sent him along to meet her, where he began by asking her how the tracks came together.
As I was listening, sometimes the story would show itself. The narrative would change because I would hear something and realize, okay, I've missed something in the plot line that the music has just shown me. So I was dependent on the muses to give me the heads up and say, we know how to work with this original theme. There was a German musicologist from Deutsche Grammophon that was very much involved. He was there online every day if I needed it to ask questions and to clarify. And he was there through the whole process, hearing demos before it was recorded with the octet. But all the writing had been completed before the recording began.
And of course, this isn't the first time that you've used the influence of classical composers on your work. I'm thinking of Yes, Anastasia, which has echoes of Debussy and Shostakovich.
is this something that you've done throughout your work and so it wasn't that new to you, or was it a completely different thing?
I felt like I had to really sharpen my skills. A composer is a sonic architect. This work was more like a sonic cathedral, building that, because it all has to interlock and it's a very big project. A musical is a sonic cathedral. That's big too. When you're doing a record, sometimes you're doing individual constructs, chalets, wonderful condos, all kinds of things, but doing a song cycle or a musical is very much about a narrative, working through it.
Obviously, you're a child prodigy. You were famously expelled from the Peabody Institute for your preference for rock music over classical music. Do you feel that a project like this takes it full circle in a way?
Well, I guess it does. They've sent me notes, really, really kind things. The deans over the years have reached out, and there's a new one there who I hope to see when I'm in Washington. But yes, I would say that if I could go back and talk to myself when I was fuming, I wouldn't believe that I would be doing variations on classical themes for a 21st century song cycle for Deutsche Grammophon. I would just look and say, yeah, right. That's never going to happen.
Dark forces are out there gathering. Dark forces are out there gathering. Some hunt for power, others to invade children's dreams.
The sort of central narrative of Night of Hunters, what lessons do you think mythology holds for the songwriter, because it's something that obviously is a thread of it through your work?
Well, you know, it's funny, not just for the songwriter, but Neil Gaiman, who is sort of my spiritual brother, and I have really looked to mythology and pushed each other to go look something up. It's been a core conversation that we've had as writers. And so I would say mythology is, if you don't know that, you don't know your chords in music. It's music theory, mythology, really, for a lyric writer or a novelist.
The musical that you're working on, The Night Princess, did you ever feel, because you're still working on it?
Oh, yes, I've been working on it for 5,000 years now.
Did you ever feel that the narratives might get intertwined between that and this?
I've been very careful. It's funny you've asked this. I mean, I've had creatures on my shoulder saying, check your reference. And the book writer of the musical, we are changing the name just because it's so far away from the original book. It doesn't help the people that think they're going to see that, because they're not seeing that.
One thing I really love about the new record is how the instrumentation plays a character. And Shattering Sea is probably my favourite on the record, and the woodwind in that really sort of conveys violence. Can you speak about the challenges of sort of positioning character in the instrumentation?
Well, we talked a lot about that, and we felt that specifically the cello and the clarinet would sometimes together, but sometimes exchange the male protagonist's energy, and that Tori's energy is very much held by the female voice there and the piano. And Jean-Philippe Chanel was very aware at all times of what the emotional tug and pull was, what the backstory was. I mean, we talked every day. So I would bring him up to speed on the narrative and the story.
Can you speak about the challenges of sort of weaving your songcraft into sort of existing classical structures, rather than sitting at the piano and letting a melody come to you?
Well, it's a different discipline, and I'm not saying I don't like it. I'm attracted to it. It really did push me to see potential structures that I haven't worked with before. Star Whisperer is the Schubert melody and chords, pretty much intact. And it seemed like if you're going to put lyrics to something so iconic and masterful, then I needed to turn to prose, and that this was the pivotal piece on the record. It was really the first one that I nailed. I had quite a few mistakes before this that weren't working, that got thrown away. But this one, once it worked, I thought, okay, let's begin.
Why Irish mythology specifically? You've tackled the mythology of so many cultures in your works, of Native American, Greek. So what led you to the Celtic side this time?
On both sides, my father and my mother's side, they're Irish great-grandfathers and grandfathers. And I really felt as if I needed to put this somewhere. I needed to locate it in a place that I had experience with. We got the Ballywilliam House in Ireland during the making of Boys for Pele. Peter Gabriel encouraged me. He said, if you get any kind of record budget, don't give it all to an outside studio. Don't be foolish. Don't be foolish, young Skywalker. He said, you know, you need to get an old place that's falling down and purchase it and record there. And I'm really glad I did.
I was wondering whether you were still drawn to the electronic elements of songs like Datura and Hotel and IIEE, which sort of went very far out in those terms.
I am drawn to it. I think, though, that I needed to do an acoustic approach. We will be experimenting on the road with doing some of the catalog, but with the quartet, with acoustic instruments. And I hope some are surprises, because we're trying to still use them as acoustic instruments, but create a very different kind of arrangement for the catalog.
I look forward to hearing Datura perform like that.
Oh my goodness, I don't know if I can do it this tour, but you know, it's on the list.
Why, oh why have you locked up your sky? Night sky, whisper me back to.
That's Tori Amos with Alex McPherson there, actually using the phrase Sonic Cathedral. Amazing.
With a straight
Alex,
face.
With a straight face. Alex, you're a big fan, as we mentioned earlier. You wrote about Choir Girl Hotel for our My Favourite Album series on the website. So what do you make of the new album?
It's okay.
That's a very, very equivocal answer, if you don't mind my saying so.
Yeah, as I think most former Tori Amos fans are aware, her albums over the last decade or so have been distinctly less good than her albums over the previous decade. Mm-hmm. And you're always waiting for the return to form. And I wouldn't say it's a return to, you know, the artistic heights of, you know, her late 90s albums. But it's certainly good to see her push herself like this and to sort of write songs based around classical melodies. You know, what I loved about her 90s work is how sometimes it just seemed completely confusing and oblique and, you know, what the hell is she doing? I don't understand it. And that was part of the appeal. But over the past decade, she seems very intent on over-explaining these concepts. Mm. I think this album came with like a 1,300-word essay.
Tell you what, I've got to be honest with you, man. Everyone has their individual tastes. And if you were trying to sell an album to me, if you told me it was a classical music influenced concept album with themes of Irish mythology that came with a 13,000-word essay, that it's like you've specifically made an album to get on my tits. Does it feel like a kind of academic exercise? Is that part of the problem? It sounds a little bit like it might be an academic exercise.
Less so than some of the concepts she's come out with in the past. And I actually deliberately didn't read the 1,300-word essay.
Good for you.
Because I didn't want that to sort of have to think about that when listening to the songs.
What does it say? I mean, have you read it subsequently? What does it say? What is it about? Does it actually explain what the plot of the album? What's
yes,
there for?
Yes, there's a shape-shifting fox who appears to a woman having a relationship.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Exactly.
Yeah.
No, you can't take it seriously. The fox is called Annabelle, and it's played on record by her daughter.
Okay. Doreen, are you a Tori Amos fan? Not anymore.
To a degree. I mean, actually, one thing I've interviewed on a couple of occasions, and one thing that's kind of both annoying and weirdly endearing is her complete straight-faced pretentiousness, the way that she referred to Neil Gaiman as her spiritual brother, without any of that kind of air-quotey, second-guessing, self-effacing thing that you would get from most interviewees.
Yeah.
And it's like she really does inhabit her own headspace. You know, she, like a lot of artists, I think, you know, they started off with some crossover hits, with a sense of being part of the pop landscape, and then just pursues this stuff. And I think I kind of like the fact that she would think there was nothing strange about this whatsoever. She doesn't even have that kind of quality that, say, Björk has when she does something that's rather rococo and kind of goes, I know this is a bit daft, but, you know, I'm giving it a go.
Yeah.
I like the fact that she just thought, yes, I will do a song cycle about a shape-shifting fox based in Irish mythology. Why not?
Yeah. No, it's good to not be afraid of pretension. I think that is actually quite a positive thing.
And at the album's best, you know, the narrative and the pretentiousness doesn't matter. On the opening track, Shattering Sea, it's this amazingly dramatic song which starts with a line, that is not my blood on the bathroom floor, which is a fantastic opening line.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But at its worst, it is a bit sort of away with the fairies, a bit sort of therapy speak. But it's the sort of drama of that opening track and that sort of blood and guts feeling which has been lacking in her work over the past decade or so, and it's good to see it sort of come back in flashes.
Yeah, absolutely. The album Night of the Hunters is out now. I should say, actually, I do, before people sort of start writing, I do actually rather like Tori Amos, and I do like her work. I haven't heard this new album. It sounds ghastly to me, but I don't doubt Alex's word that there are good things on it. It is out now. Finally, on this week's programme, you should have heard by now the news that REM are to split after 31 years. If you hadn't, sorry for breaking it to you like that. Dorian, you put the piece together for Guardian Music the other day. You are a fan, aren't you? You're an REM fan.
Yes.
Why are they special to you?
I kind of discovered them in my late teens. Actually, I had a job as a door-to-door salesman. And the guy...
Did you really?
Yeah.
What were you selling?
Restaurant discount vouchers.
Wow.
It was very weird because I was cripplingly shy. So it was basically some kind of psychological torment.
I was going to say trial by fire, yeah.
Yeah. But the guy who employed me...
Was Michael
to his cost. was a massive REM fan.
Right.
And so I remember hearing... You know, Life's Rich Pageant and Document and Green in the car. You know, and then I remember when Losing Religion, My Religion came out, that was kind of a big moment in my sixth form, you know, that single and Smells Like Teen Spirit were kind of the ones of that year. What I really like about them, perhaps in retrospect, with more sort of adult ears, is the way that I think they traced such a kind of graceful and steady and dignified trajectory from Murmur to Automatic for the People, you know, and argue that those are the two masterpieces, and one is the masterpiece of very different reasons. One is very elusive and mood-based and youthful, and then the other one is very much, you know, the voice of experience, much clearer, much more emotionally direct. And then in between, each album, you know, was bigger than the one before. But they did it well. They did it with, you know, with imagination, with some risks. You know, even when the songs that didn't work, like that terrible radio song with KRS-One, it was like, fair play to them for, you know, doing a song in 1990 with KRS-One. And they just seemed to have to retain an intelligence and a degree of mystery. You know, I mean, even Man on the Moon, Big Anthem or whatever, it is a kind of weird song about an avant-garde comedian that most people only remember as the guy from Taxi.
Yeah.
You know, this was not what rock bands generally did. And I think that the 90s material was in that kind of flawed but interesting category. I mean, New Adventures in Hi-Fi I love. I like bits of Monster and Up. And, you know, I don't think one can be too hard on the kind of diminishing returns of the last decade. And really, you know, Around the Sun's awfulness doesn't detract one iota from the greatness of that early run.
I think you need sometimes to go back, particularly if you were a rock critic who has had to review a lot of recent REM albums, such as myself. It's very good to go back and remind yourself of how great REM actually were, which I did earlier this year. Life's Rich Pageant was reissued, and it's an album I hadn't heard probably since I was about 16 years old. And I put it on in the car. I was driving down to Glastonbury, and I put it on in the car. And I was just astonished by what a good album it is. It's just swaggeringly confident, brilliant, probably the best opening run of songs on any album of its era. I think the opening four tracks just amazing. Ultimately, the legacy of a band doesn't rest on the boring records they make after their peak. No one, if you talk about the Ramones, no one goes, God, I tell you what, you know what I mean? Halfway to Sanity is not a very good album. They talk about the first three, four Ramones albums, which are amazing. And I think that's how REM will be remembered. Let us go through their back catalogue a little bit. Pick out a few highlights. I want one from early REM, I want one from mid REM, and I want one from late period REM, please.
Early period, Radio Free Europe was always my favourite. Kind of, you could see their post-punk roots, you could see their Gang of Four fandom there.
Yep.
And I love the fact that it seemed to be explicit about something. It's called Radio Free Europe, you know, it's not obviously mysterious, but then when you can't untangle the lyrics, and it doesn't matter at all, and it just seems such a great opening shot for that band. Mid-period, where are we defining that?
I suppose, okay, early is the IRS years. Mid-period is from Green to when people started to say, well, they've gone a bit shit.
I will say mid-period, Drive or Night Swimming of Automatic for the People.
Night swimming deserves a quiet night. The photograph on the dashboard taken years ago, turned around backwards so the windshield shows. Every street light reveals a picture in reverse. Still, it's so much clearer.
I think that's a wonderful record about age. You know, a lot of the songs on that album are about childhood, adolescence, in the case of Night Swimming, old age. Try Not to Breathe. It's a very graceful record, that. And then from the late period.
Yeah, tell us something to remind us that it wasn't All I Want to DJ.
I'm not going to go too late. but New Adventures in Hi-Fi, I think, is the really underrated one. I mean, it's pretty much, it's a bit too long, but it's pretty much relentlessly fantastic. Mm. And Leave is just amazing in terms of, it's a very mid-90s kind of record. It's got this siren going throughout it.
That's what keeps me. That's what keeps me. That's what keeps me down around. Leave it all behind.
Obviously them trying to be, you know, self-consciously experimental, trying to find new avenues for their sound. Mm-hmm. And I think they kind of maybe stopped trying when they got to the noughties. They realised that they couldn't find any.
Alex, you're not so keen on REM. Why didn't they do it for you?
Yeah, I'm not a fan. I've been holding my tongue on Twitter and so on, but I can hold it no longer, obviously. I just thought Michael Stipe's voice was incredibly flat and there was no nuance in it. I can't remember which album it was, but I remember hearing an REM album in full, and it's so inert that I wasn't sure whether I'd fallen asleep or the band had fallen asleep. Mm-hmm. But one song that I will always remember REM for, it's not what you'd call a highlight of their catalogue, but it needs to be brought to the world's attention, I think, because I think it's been a bit lost. It's Michael Stipe's duet with Nina Cherry in 1993, on which they rap about sex education.
Wow.
It features, you've not lived until you've heard Michael Stipe rapping the couplet, parents and teachers get together, get cool, children need to learn about sex in school.
Parents and teachers get together, get cool,
Children need to learn about sex in school. Children need to learn about sex in school. You think they don't do it? Don't get fooled.
Wow, that's amazing. Man, I love digging up stuff like that. That sounds incredible. You know what I heard this week? It's absolutely incredible. It's a version of Paranoid by Black Sabbath, sung in German, with the lyrics changed so they're about the Hound of the Baskervilles. And it's sung by a boy-girl kind of pop duo. It's just, I think they're called like Bert and Gert or something like that. It's just, my mind was blown to a billion pieces, as it sounds like my mind will be blown to a billion pieces by Michael Stipe's sex rap.
It's called Trout.
Trout?
Yeah.
Nothing sexier than Trout.
Amen. Okay, let's leave it there. There's a great artist page on the New Look Guardian Music site, which is, I think, generally, I think New Look Guardian Music site rather good. Guardian.co.uk/music/REM is where you'll find it. That's it for today's programme. Don't forget to follow us and post comments on the Music Weekly blog. All the links are at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. My thanks to Dorian for coming in, as ever. Always a pleasure, never a chore, man. And Alex, thank you for gracing us with your presence for the first time. Obviously, neither of you enjoyed it. Okay. Your silence speaks volumes, my friends. Thank you, of course, thanks most of all to you for listening in. I'm Alexis Petridis. The programme was produced by Scott Cawley. Take care. Bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.